Hello, my name's Dave Emery, and in the next half-hour segment, we're going to continue with the introduction of and or updating of a number of different stories that I consider to be of importance, and that in most cases have been dealt with either in the archive shows and or other of the For the Record segments. One of the major focal points of this program over the many, many years that I've been on the air, and for the record, that's since October of 1979, has been the profound connections between the various major corporations and international fascism. In fact, fascism was corporatism, as defined by Mussolini, who called his fascist system the corporate state, and many American corporations were front and center in the financing of not only the corporations that supported Hitler and Mussolini, but in actually providing political support for Hitler and Mussolini themselves. That's discussed in numerous programs, including the Uncle Sam and the Swastika and Uncle Sam and Il Duce programs, RFA programs 1, 2, and 10, the latter dealing with the 34 coup attempt in which some of those same industrialists and financiers attempted to overthrow Franklin Roosevelt and establish fascism in the United States. And there are numerous For the Record segments that cover the same subject material, all of those programs available from Spitfire. The corporate connections to fascism, and in particular, connections between German corporations and fascism, and between many of their American counterparts in what I have termed in the aforementioned programs a transatlantic financial and industrial axis that elevated fascism to its position of primacy in the world, those corporate connections have once again become front page news, and they are the focal point of a number of class action suits that have been filed on both sides of the Atlantic, both against some of the corporations that supported Hitler in Germany and against some of the corporations that supported Hitler from their position in the United States. Indeed, 70% of the capital that went to build up Nazi industry and find the financial bulwarks that supported Adolf Hitler came from the United States and Britain, mostly the United States. That's also discussed, by the way, in the four-part interview with John Loftus, the author, along with Mark Ahrens, of The Secret War Against the Jews, and that, too, is available from Spitfire. Among the stories covering some of those corporate connections and the lawsuits against them is an article that appeared in the New York Times of Thursday, February 18th of 1999. Indeed, researchers are now very much in demand on both sides of those lawsuits. Many of the corporations that are defendants are looking for researchers to provide exculpatory material, and many of the plaintiffs are looking for researchers to provide supporting information as well. I would point out that the information pointing out the support that many of those corporations gave Hitler is copious and has been on the public record for a long time. Some of the aforementioned archive shows and For the Record segments are among those programs that document that. This particular article from the New York Times of 2/18/99 is by Barry Meyer, M-E-I-E-R. It's headlined, Chroniclers of Collaboration, subtitled, Historians are in demand to study corporate ties to Nazis. The article reads in part, Last year, Greg Bradsher, B-R-A-D-S-H-E-R, a senior archivist at the National Archives, got an urgent request from the Ford Motor Company not long after the car maker was named in a lawsuit accusing it of profiting from its German operations in the Nazi era. Ford's idea? To send a SWAT team of 30 researchers to a government document repository so that it could hunt down every scrap of paper dealing with Ford's activities in World War II. When Mr. Bradsher replied that there were not enough library carts to accommodate such a team, Ford offered to ship its own carts. Eventually, Ford relented, trimming its request to about 6 people. For banks, insurers, and companies like Ford, the mounting wave of Holocaust-related lawsuits has created both a litigation and public relations nightmare. But the lawsuits have also created a mini-boom for one unlikely group, historians and research specialists. Skipping down again, academics hired by companies to investigate their wartime roles insist they are given the freedom and resources to seek out the truth. I would add that remains to be seen. Saul Friedlander, F-R-I-E-D-L-A-N-D-E-R, a history professor at the University of Tel Aviv, said he was approached recently by officials of Bertelsmann, the German publishing company, after an article in a Swiss magazine accused the company of, among other things, publishing pro-Nazi and anti-Semitic books in the Nazi years. I would add those allegations are beyond dispute. And I would note that in the case of the German companies that are defendants in these lawsuits, they remain inextricably linked with the deadly Bormann Flight Capital Organization, literally the economic component of a Third Reich gone underground. Of the Third Reich, contrary to popular opinion, was not an aberration, but the outgrowth of very powerful forces, as these lawsuits have indicated. And beyond that, it didn't disappear. It went underground and has perpetuated itself in a fashion not unlike the way the Mafia has, clandestinely, effectively, and deadly over many generations. Continuing and skipping down with this story, but as the pace of Holocaust litigation intensified, the stakes quickly rose. Ms. Kleiman was soon lured away by Cohn, Milstein, Hausfeld, and Toll, a class action law firm in Washington that has filed many Holocaust-related lawsuits. And while some researchers at the National Archives still wear blue jeans, it's not uncommon these days to spot corporate researchers wearing suits and gold cufflinks. And by the way, that Kleiman is Miriam Kleiman, who was contacted in connection with a suit against Swiss banks. And skipping down, but Ford is by no means alone in its quest for academic all-stars. General Motors recently hired Henry A. Turner, a professor of history at Yale University, to investigate the activities of its German subsidiary Adam Opel during the Nazi era. And Degussa AG, a German-based company accused of profiting from gold looted from Holocaust victims, has retained Peter Hayes, a professor at Northwestern University, to research its past. These lawsuits are front and center in the news and have been potentially affecting Deutsche Bank's takeover of Bankers Trust. Indeed, as I said, the Third Reich and fascism in general was not an aberration, but was the outgrowth of very powerful forces, chiefly this transatlantic financial and industrial axis involving the major corporate players in both the United States and Germany, as well as elsewhere. It was that transatlantic financial and industrial axis that produced fascism in the first place and has been complicit in perpetuating it in the post-war years. That transatlantic industrial axis is still, to a certain extent, very much functioning, is implied in an article that was carried in the Financial Times of London of Tuesday, March 2nd of 1999. This is a very interesting hiring by one of the law firms that is figuring very prominently in some of the lawsuits that have been filed against German companies. Again, this from the Financial Times of London of 3/2/1999. This is an article headlined, Wissmann Joins Washington Firm. Matthias Wissmann, W-I-S-S-M-A-N-N, the treasurer of Germany's CDU opposition party and a former transport minister, has become a partner of the Washington law firm of Wilmer, Cutler & Pickering in one of the most dramatic attempts yet by U.S. lawyers to export their regulatory expertise to Europe. The firm is best known in Europe for its role in representing the Swiss banks when they were sued in the U.S. over their alleged confiscation of assets belonging to Holocaust survivors. It is now working for several German companies being sued over their use of slave labor during the Second World War. By the way, the CDU party is the party that was in power for some 16 years. Helmut Kohl is a member of the CDU-CSU coalition. And so please note this is a very, very significant figure for Wilmer, Cutler, and Pickering to be taking on. And again, he's a former transport minister of Germany. And note that this company is now working for several German, this law firm, I should say, is now working for several German companies being sued over their use of slave labor during the Second World War. Skipping down, senior lawyers at Wilmer, Cutler believe it, beginning again, senior lawyers at Wilmer, Cutler make it clear they believe Europe could be a big market for them, pointing to the lead that Brussels is already taking in privacy issues and to the difficulty some U.S. mergers have had in gaining EU clearance. Indeed, there is a growing controversy between the EU and between U.S. companies seeking to merge with other companies in Europe and or do business there. Privacy with regard to companies' employees is much more rigorous in Europe, and the sharing of information by those companies with other entities is much more closely restricted in Europe than it is in the United States. And as American companies have attempted to move into Europe, they faced considerable resistance by the EU. That is one of the things obviously being targeted here by Wilmer, Cutler, and Pickering. Keep an eye on the following possibility, and I want to stress at the outset this is a speculative development and should be viewed as such with all critical distance required. It'll be interesting to see if Matthias Wissmann's presence on Wilmer, Cutler, and Pickering leads to a relatively soft handling of the German companies being sued for their use of slave labor. And it'll be interesting in turn to see if the EU, dominated by Germany, in turn relaxes some of its privacy regulations with regard to corporate intrusion into the privacy of its employees and the sharing of information with other entities. That's only, obviously, a speculative element, but keep your eyes peeled for a possible quid pro quo. Again, keep your eyes peeled for the lawsuits against companies being represented by Wilmer, Cutler, and Pickering to be tempered somewhat and or mitigated in some fashion. And keep your eyes peeled for a corresponding relaxation on the part of the EU on the restrictions with regard to companies sharing information about their employees. Again, I'm not necessarily saying that's going to happen, but I find it very interesting that a former transport minister of Germany and a CDU politician is being taken on by Wilmer, Cutler, and Pickering, who are representing several German companies being sued in the lawsuits I talked about in that New York Times article from 2/18/99. And in turn, senior lawyers at Wilmer Cutler think Europe could be a big market for them. And this is in regard to the fact that Brussels is taking a lead in privacy issues. Again, keep your eyes peeled for that possible quid pro quo. In a half-hour segment entitled U.S.-German Intelligence Wars, I talked about the growing friction between U.S. and German intelligence. Indeed, I think to a considerable extent, the battle lines of World War II are being redrawn, with Germany on the one side and the United States, and even though it's an EU member, Great Britain, on the other. I think those divisions are currently playing out with regard to sanctions against Iraq, with the United States and Britain taking the lead against Iraq. Saddam Hussein and Iraq are to a considerable extent a German proxy in the Middle East, much as Israel is to a considerable extent an American and British proxy in that same part of the world. But again, as I noted in that half-hour segment available from Spitfire entitled German-U.S. Intelligence Wars, with regard to intelligence matters, the battle lines of World War II are being redrawn to a considerable extent in the wake of the Cold War and as the triumphant Western nations begin what some would view as the inevitable quest for empire. The San Francisco Chronicle of Thursday, March 4th of 1999, carried an article from the Washington Post, which further delineates some of the growing friction between U.S. and German intelligence. This is an article by William Drozdiak, Drozdiak, of the Washington Post. It's headlined, U.S. Keeping East Germany's Spy Files Despite Berlin's Claim. The article reads as follows. When Gerhard Schroeder was invited to lunch at the White House by President Clinton last month, the German Chancellor was fervently hoping he would return home with a special gift, the top-secret archives of East Germany's foreign spy operations that the CIA spirited away after the fall of the Berlin Wall. By the time he arrived in Washington, however, Schroeder received disappointing news. Not only would Clinton not release the files, he did not even want to discuss the matter, according to White House and Chancellery aides. While Schroeder sought to dismiss the rebuff by declaring that the two leaders simply did not have enough time to discuss the issue, senior aides said privately that the Chancellor was outraged by the United States' refusal to surrender files that Germany considers its property. They warned that the impasse soon could seriously damage cooperation on intelligence between the countries. German officials hint that the time may be coming to curtail operations of U.S. intelligence agencies in Germany, including eavesdropping facilities such as the powerful U.S. radar and communication systems at Bad Aibling, A-I-B-L-I-N-G, near Munich, that some Germans suspect are used for commercial espionage. According to diplomats, politicians, and intelligence officials interviewed in the United States and Germany, the campaign to recover the crown jewels, unquote, of the East German state security apparatus, or Stasi, has escalated into an emotional test case for Schroeder's government as it seeks to reassert the full sovereignty of a reunited Germany and establish a more equitable partnership with Washington. The files are said to contain the identities, code names, and other vital data of thousands of Stasi foreign agents, the vast majority of whom worked in West Germany. The Clinton administration has refused to return the files at the insistence of the CIA, which says that doing so would jeopardize Western agents still at large. But many Germans believe the U.S. attempt to protect Germans and other Westerners implicated in the files, some of whom are believed still to hold powerful political positions, is preventing Germany from settling its accounts with history and achieving a full reconciliation between East and West. Carsten Voigt, V-O-I-G-T, the coordinator of U.S.-German relations for the German Foreign Ministry, said it is ironic that in the eyes of many Germans, the United States is aligning itself with former communists and their sympathizers who have been trying desperately to cover up the truth about their past. We simply find it hard to understand how a great country which says it stands for freedom behaves like those in Germany who are trying to block access to the files, unquote, Voigt said. During the 40-year history of East Germany, between 20 and 30,000 West Germans are believed to have worked for the Stasi. With language posing no obstacle, it easily infiltrated almost every sector of West German society, including business, politics, academia, labor unions, and the media. There are a variety of possible interpretations as to why this particular impasse is growing. First of all, it should be seen in the context of other friction between U.S. and German intelligence, including friction between German intelligence and the FBI, the CIA, and using the EU as a proxy, the National Security Agency, with the EU putting heat on the vital National Security Agency electronic listening post at Menwith Hill in Yorkshire. That post, which shares functions with the United Kingdom's intelligence, is an absolutely essential American intelligence apparatus. And as I said in the aforementioned half-hour segment talking about U.S.-German intelligence wars, and also in a pair of half-hour segments recorded in August of 1998, updating a number of stories, the EU translation, Germany's Pressure on the Menwith Hill Station, in the information age, it could be viewed as much the same as Japan's attack on Pearl Harbor in World War II. That attack was intended to neutralize the U.S. 7th Fleet's ability to operate in Asia, and specifically to block the Japanese offensive directed at the Indonesian oil fields. In the information age, and we are in the information age, the attempts to compromise Menwith Hill could be viewed as the equivalent of the Japanese attack on Pearl Harbor and an act of war. That would fundamentally compromise U.S. intelligence's electronic ears on Europe, going all the way up to the Ural Mountains. And again, as I stated in that pair of half-hour segments, it is essential to American national interests to retain that listening post. And this is an instance in which the American citizenry should support the National Security Agency, as ludicrous as that will appear to some. I'm not even sure how one could go about doing that. A couple of other reflections on this particular story. For one thing, one of the possibilities that should be seriously considered is that these files may be being withheld until the EU takes the heat off Menwith Hill in sort of a quid pro quo. That's one hypothetical construct. It also may very well be that as friction between U.S. and German intelligence increases, some of these possible Stasi infiltrators into West Germany, some of whom are theorized to still be holding positions of influence in Germany, it may be that those agents may be turnable, one could say, to work for the United States. That's also a possibility that I think should be seriously considered. Both may, in fact, be the case. But this is an instance in which I think the Clinton administration and the CIA deserve the support of the American people. That will, again, appear strange to veteran listeners to the program, in that the fundamental anti-fascist focus of my work has necessarily directed me toward exposing the abuses, many of them deadly, of U.S. intelligence where they exist. I continue to do that, but on the other hand, as a patriotic American, this is an instance where the CIA, like the NSA with regard to Menwith Hill, deserves the support of the American people. Again, with growing friction between U.S. and German intelligence, one of the things with regard to the withholding of the Stasi files that needs to be seriously considered is that the agents discussed in those files might be turnable, so to speak, toward service for U.S. intelligence as, again, the battle lines of World War II are being redrawn. More about the EU's heat on Menwith Hill. This from the San Jose Mercury News of Saturday, December 12th of 1998. In the Washington News in Brief section of the Mercury News for 12-12-98, we find the following. U.S. espionage controversy sweeps Europe. The National Security Agency has disclosed that U.S. intelligence is holding 1,056 pages of classified information about the late Princess Diana, inspiring a flurry of sensational headlines this week across London's tabloids. Skipping down, NSA has been the subject of intense controversy in Britain and across Europe since a report released in January by the European Parliament concluded that, quote, within Europe, all email, telephone, and fax communications are routinely intercepted, unquote, by the NSA. The report focused on a system called Echelon through which the NSA and its spy partners in Britain, Canada, New Zealand, and Australia share communications intercepted worldwide. And again, this is a reference to the Menwith Hill situation, and that is an instance it is absolutely essential that to American interests to retain the Menwith Hill listening station, and this is an instance in which it is important to support the NSA. Again, I don't know how one would go about doing that, or even if such a thing is possible, but that's my view on things for the record. Again, that'll appear strange to veteran listeners in that the anti-fascist focus of the program has directed me toward exposing abuses of U.S. intelligence where they exist. And in that context, the following story appears. This from the San Francisco Chronicle of Friday, November 13th of 1998. One of the ugliest abuses by an element of U.S. intelligence, and specifically this is the Nazi-linked element of U.S. intelligence, which is extremely powerful, was Jonestown in all likelihood. In RFA programs 6 and 7, I discuss some very disturbing information indicating that Jonestown, or the People's Temple, the People's Temple with its Jonestown, Guyana outpost, was in fact used by U.S. intelligence, if indeed the entire Jonestown and People's Temple operations were not U.S. intelligence operations per se. Richard Dwyer, the CIA chief of mission in Guyana, was present at the massacre in November of 1978. The Forbes Burnham government had been installed by the CIA and was actively supported by People's Temple personnel in Guyana. A fellow named George Philip Blakey, who worked for the CIA in Angola, put down the down payment on the Jonestown property. And there are a number of other interesting connections, not only between U.S. intelligence and the People's Temple, but there are evidentiary tributaries running from the House Select Committee on Assassinations investigation of the Martin Luther King assassination and the People's Temple. That discussed, by the way, in RFA 8, all of those programs available from Spitfire. Again, some very interesting information about a possible U.S. intelligence interest in or connection to the People's Temple was carried in the San Francisco Chronicle of Friday, November 13th of 1998. This is an article by Michael Taylor and Don Latin of the San Francisco Chronicle. It's headlined, "Most People's Temple Documents Still Sealed." It reads in part as follows. For nearly 20 years, there have been rumors that the Reverend Jim Jones was either under surveillance by the CIA and the FBI, or that he was working for the CIA. There was even a rumor that he had taken his followers to Jonestown as part of the MK-Ultra mind control program, a CIA effort that tried, among other things, to duplicate Soviet and Chinese brainwashing techniques to force recalcitrant spies to reveal sensitive secrets. The government said MK-Ultra was ended in 1973. Congressional investigations into Jones's People's Temple never substantiated such rumors. But Congress has never declassified some 5,000 pages of documents that scholars and conspiracy buffs would love to go through. J. Gordon Melton, M-E-L-T-O-N, founder and director of the Institute for the Study of American Religion, said he does not know what the documents might reveal. But he said they need to be made public, quote, so we can finally figure out what role the U.S. government had down there, unquote. Again quoting, Jonestown was closely monitored by the government, unquote, Melton said, again quoting, the CIA and the State Department were regularly checking in on Jonestown, unquote. And quoting a researcher named Fielding McGahee from North Dakota, skipping down, we read, quote, lots of boxes of material went into the House Committee files, unquote, McGahee said. It's like the supporting material on the Kenneth Starr report, but it was never released. We asked Congress to release it, but got no reply, unquote. There are, however, a few places where voluminous government information about People's Temple is available. In January, amateur historian Brian Shook, CSUK, asked the State Department what it had on Jonestown. To his surprise, the department sent him nearly 6,100 pages of material. He has put a lot of this information on a website at www.icehouse.net/zodiac. That again is www.icehouse.net/zodiac. It remains to be seen just what is in the voluminous body of information that has not been released by the government. I suspect there's a reason that that has not been released, and I expect that that would be very damning to those government agencies that are withholding that. Again, for more information about U.S. intelligence connections to Jonestown, RFA programs 6, 7, and 8. A key player in the Layton family, one of the major families involved with the People's Temple, passed away just this past week. As I speak on the evening of Sunday, March 7th, or as I record this on the evening of Sunday, March 7th of 1999, the San Francisco Chronicle of Friday, March 5th of 1999, carried the following story by Michael Taylor. It's the obituary of Lawrence Layard Layton. Lawrence Layard Layton, L-A-Y-T-O-N, a distinguished scientist whose later life was devastated by his family's involvement with the People's Temple cult, died Wednesday in his Emeryville home. Skipping down, during World War II, he did research on cancer and the healing of wounds at Johns Hopkins University's School of Hygiene and Public Health in Baltimore. After the war, Mr. Layton had a series of government jobs. In the early 1950s, he was chief of chemical warfare at the Army's Dugway Proving Ground in Utah. In 1954, he was named director of research at the Navy's munitions factory in Indian Head, Maryland, where he designed missile fuels. Many of his papers on this top-secret work are still classified. And skipping down, discussing his wife Lisa Layton, by the way, the daughter of a prominent lawyer for I.G. Farben and Siemens prior to and during World War II, by the early 1970s, Mr. Layton's personal life changed in ways he had hardly thought possible. His wife Lisa, his daughter Deborah, and another son Larry all became disciples of the Reverend Jim Jones, the charismatic leader of the People's Temple cult. They all joined People's Temple, and Larry and Deborah Layton quickly became two of Jones's closest confidants. In 1977, after a magazine exposé, Jones and his followers fled to Jonestown, a compound carved out of the remote jungles of Guyana. Lisa, Deborah, and Larry Layton all went to Jonestown, but in May of 1978, Deborah, increasingly disturbed by Jones' paranoid ravings and brutal treatment of his flock, escaped and flew back to the United States. Her mother and brother stayed behind. Lisa Layton, already ill with cancer, died in early November of 1978. 10 days later, on November 18th, Jones and 912 of his followers committed mass suicide. Larry Layton later became the only person ever charged in connection with a massacre at the nearby Port Kaituma airstrip. And I would note that Representative Ryan was the co-author of the Hughes-Ryan Amendment, which obliged the CIA to give Congress prior notification of impending covert operations. That was not something that the CIA much approved of. And again, he died in that particular massacre. I've alluded to various tapes available from Spitfire. They can be reached at P.O. Box 1179, Ben Lomond, California, 95005. Email spitfire@ix.netcom.com. My name's Dave Emery. Thanks for listening.